Staying in business means closing the deal and making the sale.
A, B, C. A, always B, B, C, closing. Always be closing. Always be closing.
The president knows it. Tonight, his pitch to Congress and to the primetime audience of skeptical voters. He hasn't always been closing, but he better start.
You get the picture? You're laughing now? You got leads. Get their names to sell them.
Barack Obama gets the picture. First prize, a health care overhaul and a huge political victory. Second prize, a set of steak knives. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 9th. I'm Lynn Scher, joined by Todd Zwillick. We're in for John Hockenberry. Morning, Todd.
Good morning, Lynn.
Coming up this hour, get your remote control guitar out. The Beatles go rock band today. And the dramatic helicopter rescue of a New York Times reporter. Also in our regular food talks, we find out why locavores may be getting it wrong.
But first, Cindy Gallup, advertising consultant and friend of The Takeaway. We've heard of death panels and socialized medicine and killing off grandma. Cindy, what does it mean for the salesman-in-chief to try to be selling a damaged brand tonight?
Well, I think you have to tackle the damage head on. You have to be prepared to be completely honest about the areas of perceived damage, to be very straightforward about correcting any miscommunication, and to be very clear and honest about how you plan to repair that damage going forward.
All right, the salesman-in-chief with a damaged brand in front of the country tonight, Cindy Gallup. Stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
And Todd, in the headlines, the president says his speech to Congress will clarify how he wants to move forward with health care reform. Here's what he told ABC News.
We're not being rigid and ideological about this thing, but we do intend to get something done this year.
Mr. Obama is expected to lay out how to pay for health care for millions of uninsured Americans. The GOP is already lining up its response. Louisiana representative and physician Charles Bustani will answer the presidential address.
Overseas, in what's being described as a dramatic helicopter rescue, NATO forces have freed New York Times reporter Stephen Farrell. He was kidnapped in northern Afghanistan on Saturday, but Farrell's Afghan translator and a British commando were killed in the rescue. Staying abroad, Iran gives new proposals on its nuclear program to members of the UN Security Council today. That's as the U.S. says it has serious concerns that Iran will try to keep an option open for building nuclear weapons.
Markets were up just under 1% yesterday. The Dow opens next hour at 94.97. The S&P starts trade at 10.25. And the Nasdaq begins at 20.38. Tonight, President Obama goes before Congress to pitch his health care plan, as we've been telling you. We're looking for your best 20-second pitch for why a new health care plan should or shouldn't pass.
This is Mary Elizabeth Williams, culture critic for The Takeaway and Salon.com, and here is my healthcare reform pitch. The Center for American Progress estimates that 14,000 Americans are losing their health insurance every day. Do you want to wait until the middle of flu season to find out that you're one of them?
Okay, how about you? What's your pitch? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. On this Wednesday morning, I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here with Lynn Scher. We're both filling in for John Hockenberry. Well, do you remember this little piece of presidential history?
If Americans are to have the courage to change in a difficult time, we must first be secure in our most basic needs. Tonight, I want to talk to you about the most critical thing we can do to build that security. This health care system of ours is badly broken, and it is time to fix it.
This health care system of ours is badly broken, and it's time to fix it. Yes, thank you, President Bill Clinton. Back in 1993, President Obama is now trying to sell his own health plan reform to Congress tonight and to American voters, of course, for a blueprint of what this president needs to say to sell that latest incarnation of health reform. We have a couple of distinguished guests with us this morning. Cindy Gallup is an advertising consultant and former chair of ad agency BBH. She's in the studio with us. And Ted Widmer is a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton. Cindy, welcome.
Thank you.
So we talked a little bit before about the damaged brand and, of course, things like death panels, things like socialist, Marxist, government takeover, all very strong marketing buzzwords, in my view. What words can the president use or posture? What does he use in the House of Representatives chamber tonight to fix that brand?
Well, I think in the first instance, actually, a successful speech always starts with a very clear sense of who your target audience is. This one's a bit of a nightmare because there are a lot of very different, very distinct target audiences.
Politicians and voters all across the gamut.
Absolutely. And so I think that subjectively speaking, the president will be best focusing on the American people as the key audience amongst all the many who are hanging on his every word. In that context, it's tremendously important to bring simplicity and clarity to the entire debate. And those are, I'd suggest, fundamental precepts that he should be operating tonight.
And does he focus on what this means for the voters, for instance? He focuses on what this means to you, your costs, your premiums, your health. Most of the polls show that everyone wants people to have health insurance, but nobody wants to contribute to that effort. How do you sell that?
He's got an enormously difficult task. He has to simplify and synthesize a number of very complex concepts into something that everyone can understand and feel that they have clarity in their own minds about. And I think in that sense, we're going to be looking for some highly memorable sound bites, which he's certainly proved he's a master of in the past.
All right, Ted Widmer, former speechwriter for Bill Clinton. You're now director of the Center for Early American History at Brown University. You've written speeches like this before. You've made the sales job before. What's your advice for the president and his speechwriters tonight?
I actually only worked on foreign policy, so I've never written a healthcare speech. But
you've written important speeches, that's for sure.
Well, I agree with what Cindy said. We need clarity. I think this is a subject that Americans feel very daunted by, and he needs to break it down into basic concepts. But he also needs to root it in essential American values, fairness, efficiency, moving ahead into a future that has become a little bit scarier over the last year, and helping each other out. And he needs to clearly state why the pros of this outweigh the cons. I think he hasn't quite made that argument yet, but I think he will tonight.
And in something, Ted, in something so complex as healthcare reform, a 1,000-page bill, the polls show clearly most Americans don't understand it. Most reporters won't admit it, but they don't understand it either. Most members of Congress don't understand it fully. Is the speech job easier in that case because you can define what the issues are, or is it more difficult because people don't really understand the facts?
I think it's pretty difficult. I think healthcare is very confusing. Even the experts admit this, and basic people like you and me and Cindy, it's very, very hard to understand all these complicated financial and medical concepts. But we do have a master explainer up there, and this is a perfect time to really lead. We've all come back from summer vacation. It's the fall is beginning, and it's a serious issue. And I think he really hasn't explained it well enough yet. So this is a very important moment to do that tonight.
Ted, it's Lynn Scherr. At this time of such extraordinary partisanship, this man who came in talking about bipartisan possibilities, how does he thread his way through that? What do you as a speechwriter do to not only maintain your base but bring in the other side, particularly when it's so divided?
Well, basic human stories always work well, just telling how individuals have been affected by bad health care policies over the past. He's strengthened in a way by the story of Clinton's failure at the beginning of his presidency, because we all know what happened then, and we've seen the quality of health care decline and the costs go up a lot. So in a way, that moves some momentum over to his side. The Republicans succeeded in defeating reform 16 years ago, and so now there's a real reason to try again to get it right.
All right, let me bring in Lisa Schifrin. She's a former speechwriter for Vice President Dan Quayle, another speechwriter just like you, Ted, but on the Republican side. Lisa, how do you see the president's sales task through the speech tonight? He needs clarity in a complex issue and clarity in a good sales pitch in front of an extremely diverse audience. How do you think you should approach it?
The two things I think are most important are, first, as the previous guest said, his explanatory powers need to be need to be used in full. This is such a major, major change in our economy and in the nature of our society that if he wants to convince the center, and he will not convince the right. Anybody who has a principled right. objection to the government running health care will not be convinced. But what he needs is to convince the center and to make people, to allay their anxiety. The way he needs to do that is by slowing down, by not appearing to ram anything through or make anybody vote quickly, and seriously explaining both sides, the costs and the benefits. And we know the current system has many, many costs. We know that it doesn't work as well as it needs to, but we also know it has a lot of benefits. So he needs to explain what will change and how that will affect things overall.
All right, Cindy Gallo.
Almost as important is his tone. There can be none of this triumphalism, and you know, over the weekend when he spoke at a Labor Day.
Sure. But to a friendly audience, let me turn to Cindy Gallup really quick. Cindy, you're an ad professional. You know, Lisa just mentioned that the right is not going to be sold by this, and you know, I think of it from your perspective, maybe in terms of an infomercial. You know, there's certain things that Todd Zwillick, I'm just not buying, no matter how good the commercial. I'm not buying a Snuggie or whatever those blankets are called. I'm not buying one. So does the president know that the right is just not going to buy it and he doesn't bother selling to them, or does he try to include them as well in his message?
I actually think that if he goes for a message that is truly straightforward, simple, clear, and honest to the American people, that's the best he can do in terms of looking to get everybody to understand what he's doing and get on board. When we are confused and feel that we don't understand something we should, the natural human reaction is to actually become irritable and annoyed. The more everybody feels there is total clarity and we can talk to each other in a common language about what he's looking to do, the more I believe there will be a more favorable reception for what he has to say.
How about shame? A lot of great commercials use shame. You're not on board. You're not a good mother. What about shaming people with the prospect of not acting when we're in a healthcare crisis?
Actually, as an ad person, I don't believe in making people feel negative in order to do something. I believe it's much more about giving them positive reasons to do something, and that's absolutely what he has to do.
Negative works in politics sometimes, you know, sort of swinging the axe of potential loss.
And guilt works.
And guilt works great.
I would actually say that those tactics have been deployed far too often in politics, and that's one of the changes we want to see going forward.
So the takeaway from this conversation, the president needs to be clear, he needs to inspire, but he also needs to show people what's in it for them. Those are, of course, the best ads. That's Cindy Gallup, advertising consultant. Lisa Schifrin, former speechwriter for Dan Quayle, and Ted Winmer, former speechwriter for Bill Clinton. I want to point out real quickly that I'll be in Detroit this evening. The Takeaway is participating in a town hall on healthcare thrown by the great WDET in Detroit, which is Takeaway Station. It's a chance for listeners in Detroit to and the community to come and get their answers about this complex and important piece of legislation asked and answered. It's all happening at Wayne State University tonight. You can find out more information on wayne.edu. And also, don't worry about missing the president's speech, because after the event ends, they're going to show the president's speech on closed circuit right there in the auditorium. So come out if you can.
All right. You've got the microphone there tonight. And I now want to turn the microphone over to our listeners right now. We are looking for your best 20-second pitch for why a new health care plan should or shouldn't pass.
Hi, this is Mansoor from Brooklyn. My take on Obama's healthcare plan is that I think it's going to be a boondoggle for all the industries involved. We're going to just hand over 40 million customers to the insurance companies, doctors, and hospitals.
So what do you think? I mean, come up with a pitch, you know? America, this is why, blah, blah, blah. Give us your pitch. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
All right, the new video game, The Beatles Rock Band, will be released in stores today. In fact, it started selling, I think, at midnight just a few hours ago. Now, this is the first time the Beatles have allowed their music to be sold in a digital format. In the game, players score points by playing their chosen role with replica instruments. The better you play, the higher your score. Unfortunately, the better you play, not the more money you make. But then again, in real music, you don't have to play well to make money all the time either. Let's face it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Lynn, you're a Beatles fan, I take it, right?
Of course I'm a Beatles fan. Everyone's a Beatles fan. This is my music.
All right, I'm a little, more than a little green. Lynn gets to actually try out Rock Band. We've got a version of it here in the studio, and what we need is an instructor. Hey, Leo, come on in here. We've got producer, takeaway producer Leo Duran is a self-professed...
You don't think I can do this on my own? You feel that I need a little help?
I have a feeling Leo might be of some good help. Judging from what you said this morning in the prep, I think you need some help.
Okay,
all right, Leo, what's this game all about? Rock Band, people have heard of Guitar Hero. What's this game
all
about?
Yeah, so essentially both of them are video games. It's kind of like you're melding playing guitar plus playing karaoke. So essentially, like, what you'll see on the game is that it'll tell you which buttons to hit at which time. And the better you do, the better scores you get. It's kind of like if you're playing karaoke with your friends. You can either be good or bad. If you hit the notes right, if you sing along with the words at the right time, you'll do better. It's just in this case, you get scores for it.
Karaoke on a fake guitar.
Yeah, essentially. And what's great about this is that you can sing, you can play the bass, you can play guitar or drums. You have like four different options depending on which one you're better at or which one you want
to
really
guitar.
Suck at. Okay.
Okay, I'm
going to teach her.
Leo's got his fake plastic guitar in the corner there that he's going to show Lynn with the color coded buttons, and we've got Beatles Rock Band up on the flat screen TV here in the Takeaway Studios.
We'll do a twist and shout, so we'll practice while you go about your business.
Just want to point out there's all these cool colored buttons, and I basically know how it works, and that you follow the colors on the bouncing colors on the screen. But Leo's going to show me the tricks to get this.
Don't be too confident before you play along with one of your songs. There, you know, there's a huge crowd listening in this game.
You are so mean, and you're so jealous.
Because it's only because I'm a little jealous. All right, so while you guys sort that out, Leo, you sort out Lynn there on Rock Band. I want to turn to Jeff Howe. He's also with us now. He's a contributing editor for Wired magazine and the author of Crowdsourcing. There it is. Here there goes Lynn. All right. Okay, so Jeff Howe, let me bring you in. Jeff, you're the author of Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. So Beatles Rock Band, Jeff, why would the Beatles decide to release their music digitally on a video game? You can't download it on iTunes. There are no legal MP3s anyway. So why on a video game like this?
Well, I think there's two reasons, if not more. One is it's a calculated bet that we're seeing isn't just a new genre of video game, but is a whole new platform for experiencing music, for reaching a whole new demographic for the Beatles. And second, I think that you have to look at the story of how this game came into being. There were a lot of personal relationships, and I think that AppleCorp, which is the company that controls the Beatles' interest, sort of fell in love with the Harmonix, the developers behind Rock Band.
So what's the better sell here for the Beatles, do you think? Does this game bring the Beatles to younger people, video game players, or does it bring video games to baby boomers and older folks who like the Beatles?
Video games to older folks.
Yeah.
I mean, we want to believe the Beatles are timeless. I, too, love the Beatles. I'm 38. I mean, I wasn't even around when they were together. But I think that the core audience for video games, let's call it, 14 to 25, they're not huge Beatle fans.
Can they become huge Beatle fans, do you think?
What's that?
Can they become huge Beatle fans or at least Beatle likers?
I absolutely believe in the power of Lennon, McCartney, and sometimes Harrison songs to persuade. So sure, some of them, but I don't think that's the big play here.
Okay, Jeff,
from a business perspective.
Let me check in with Lynn and Leo. How's it going over there, guys?
Well, we just switched songs, and I'm She's
doing a lot better
here's
now.
Here's the problem. I'm doing a lot better. But I can't talk and play at the same time.
Oh, well, okay. Well, I'll talk so and you play a little bit.
Stop screwing your eyes.
Yeah, you're not seeing my
song failed. That's okay, Lynn. Leo, help her out a little
I'm
bit
I'm loving
more.
This.
So Jeff Howe from Wired Magazine, I have to ask if there's a Michael Jackson angle to this, only because he had purchased so much of the Beatles catalog. Does his estate have any stake in this?
Sure, because Sony ATV, which owns the Beatles catalog, will make money. But, you know, that's a publishing stake, which means that whenever a deal is cut, they basically say, sure, thanks, send us a check.
Right.
You know, it's not as if Michael Jackson was leaning on Paul McCartney before his death to make a deal like this. No,
right.
Nothing of the sort.
So what's this game worth in terms of retail sales between now and Christmas? Do we have a sense of what we're talking about here?
Boy, I wish I did. That's not a number, you know, I would care to guess at. I think this game does between moderately well to exceptionally well. I think MTV either breaks even on it, or it really explodes. I don't see it being a disaster, just because if you look at the track record of the Beatles, they always sell well. I mean, everything sells well. I mean, what's amazing about the Beatles is they had one of the best selling albums of this decade.
All right, Jeff Howe with Wired Magazine here to talk with us about Beatles Rock Band, the Beatles' foray into digital music. Jeff is the author of Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. Thanks for joining us this morning. Lynn Scherr is a Beatle. Go, Lynn.
I thought you were listening to me. Okay. This
All
is
right.
the coolest thing I've done in a
All
long
right.
time.
All right, nice job. Lynn Scherr, the fifth Beatle. There she is. All right, let's check in on today's top news stories.
Sorry, I have to get my fingers out of the guitar strings here. Okay, getting serious, folks. President Obama talks health care in an address to a joint session of Congress tonight. Here is the president previewing tonight's speech in an interview with ABC News this morning.
They will have a lot of clarity about what I think is the best way to move forward.
Mr. Obama's speech will be at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Overseas in Afghanistan, NATO special forces have rescued Stephen Farrell, a kidnapped New York Times journalist from the Taliban. Mark Sedwill, the British ambassador in Kabul, spoke earlier to our partner, the BBC, about the operation.
What I can confirm is that international and Afghan forces were involved in this rescue. I want to pay tribute to their courage and professionalism. And as you know, it was successful.
One of Farrell's Afghan colleagues and a British soldier were killed in the helicopter rescue mission. We'll have more on Stephen Farrell's story in a few minutes with the editor of the New York Times, Bill Keller. States are debating whether to force healthcare workers to get flu shots to protect them against H1N1 or swine flu. New York, the first state to be hit hard by H1N1, is requiring all healthcare workers to get immunized.
And it's the ninth day of the ninth month of the ninth year of the ninth century, and plenty of couples are taking advantage of this quirky date. Wedding officials in Las Vegas are preparing for one of the busiest days of the year. Let's hope no one's standing on their heads.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Lynn Scherr. Startling news this morning from Afghanistan. A military commando raid has freed Stephen Farrell, a reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Most of us didn't even know he'd been captive. His translator and a British commando were killed in the process. For more on the rescue and the backstory, we turn to Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times. Bill, good morning. And first of all, congratulations and condolences. A mixed result today.
Thanks, Lynn. Yeah, it is. Our feelings are pretty mixed about this. I mean, obviously, we're hugely relieved to have Steve free, but Sultan Munadi, who was killed in the rescue, was a much beloved translator who's worked with many of our correspondents in Afghanistan, and we really feel his loss. And we obviously feel for the families of the British commando who gave his life in this rescue attempt.
Bill, what can you tell us about this this rescue mission? Who freed him, and how did it come about?
All they have told us at this point is that it was an international operation, including some Afghan forces. Steve, as we quoted in the story this morning, said that he heard British voices. He's an Irishman, so he would recognize a British voice. you know, beyond that, we don't know what other nationalities might have been involved.
He also, in your story, he said he and his translator, Sultan, heard the thump, thump, thump of the helicopters coming.
Right, right. They were in a house with under Taliban guard. They heard the helicopters. Everybody ran for it. To this moment, we still don't know exactly who shot whom and what went on. But when it was all over, Steve was alive and Sultan was not. And there may have been, we've heard a civilian casualty or two as well, but that hasn't been confirmed.
Talking to Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times, about the rescue of Stephen Farrell from the New York Times. You heard about the kidnapping on Saturday, is that correct?
That's right.
And you chose to keep this information from the public.
That's right. Our experience, and sadly we've had some very recent experience of this, is that that once these things catch on in the media, it raises the temperature, it creates confusion, and particularly in the early days, we had some hopes that if we could keep things calm and quiet, we might be able to negotiate a peaceful release.
Were you involved in any negotiations?
I wasn't personally negotiating with anybody, and in fact, our contacts with the kidnappers were all indirect. They hadn't made any specific demands at this point, but we knew through intermediaries that the Taliban elders in the Kunduz area were meeting to consider the case. It's a part of the country where the Taliban has some relationship with the Afghan government and tend to be a little more reasonable than in some other areas where they're close to al-Qaeda or to the Haqqani family. So we were actually holding out some hopes that there might be a release.
As a result of this, and of course as the result of the kidnapping and the freeing of David Rohde earlier this year, any hesitation in other Times reporters going into these places?
Well, the first thing we're going to do is have Stephen come out and do yet another security review. We did a pretty thorough security review after David was kidnapped, because the situation has gotten more and more perilous, not so much in Kabul, but once you get out into the countryside. So we had set up some new protocols for reporters traveling out in the field, and we're going to take another look at those now to find out whether they're strict enough.
Okay, Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times, again, congratulations and condolences to you on this day.
Thanks, Lynn.
All right, sticking in Afghanistan for another story, Afghanistan's election commission says incumbent President Hamid Karzai now has more than 54% of the votes in the presidential election. His nearest rival, Abdullah Abdullah, has 28%. Those results have been dogged by numerous allegations of cheating, and Afghan election officials say they have clear evidence of fraud. To talk about it now, we're joined by Christine Fair, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She was recently in Afghanistan as an election monitor. Christine, is there any doubt at this point that systematic fraud was an implicit part of this election?
There are certainly important locuses of very serious fraud, but to suggest that it's systematic fraud suggests that, you know, the entire national process has been subject to impropriety, and that may be the case, but the evidence is not there.
But fair enough. You noted the
South, where the security situation was particularly problematic, folks were initially concerned that people wouldn't be able to turn out. But what emerged in the weeks and days prior to the election were various allegations that the Karzai government had, for example, cut deals with Taliban commanders whereby no one would vote, but that the Taliban wouldn't stop ballot boxes being stuffed in return. And this is the kind of thing that you're seeing in Kandahar, where thousands of ballots were turned in, but in fact no one actually turned up to cast those ballots.
Now, this is no doubt putting the United States in a very difficult position, isn't it? We want to support democracy and also security in Afghanistan, plus we have a war on. What sort of damage do you think this election, this faulty election process, is doing to United States interests in our ally, Hamid Karzai?
Well, I put this ticking clock, I set the clock back about a year and a half. The United States, the international community, really tolerated and even facilitated what I would call priming of this system. Karzai, through the Independent Directorate of Local Governance, appointed district and provincial level governors that were very sympathetic. And in fact, observers of this so-called IDLG, which enjoyed U.S. and international financial support, was dubbed the Karzai reelection campaign. So in terms of tolerating using the incumbent's ability to make an uneven playing field, the international community was certainly culpable. And it wasn't really until maybe the last 9 months or so when the international community started thinking, oh, you know, maybe Karzai isn't the right man for the job, at which point, as they say, the train had sailed.
So, Christine Fair, let me ask you real quick. We only have a few seconds left,
yeah.
Unfortunately. What happens now? Does this whole thing just stay in limbo? Where do we go from here before we get the while we have this recount?
Well, the bottom line is that there's a precarious line that has to be walked. No one wants to be seen blessing a presidential election that was essentially flawed. In part, that's because we would be seen to be blessing a person that came to power through unlawful means or extra legal means. And in the context of the insurgency, you really want a president that has maximal credibility. Right. So the international community is really at a loss here. On the All other right. hand, the more they impugn Karzai for electoral irregularity, in the likely event that he'll prevail, it's not going to make him terribly inclined to want to work with the United States and the international community. So they're really trying to walk a fine line between getting as credible president out of this process as possible, subject to the reality that whoever comes out of this is going to have to be the partner that the international community works with. And that's just not a pretty picture.
A real difficult position then for the United States and the U.S. government trying to fight a war in Afghanistan while at the same time promoting some semblance of democracy. Christine Fair, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, thank you for joining us.
Coming up, if you eat organic or locally, does that mean you're eating responsibly? And what does that even mean? We'll talk more in 10 minutes.
This is The Takeaway. Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Lynn Scher. And if the last book you bought was a movie, stay tuned. Remember this?
If you force it to open, the vial breaks, vinegar dissolves the virus, and your secret is lost forever.
I've never met a girl who knew that much about a cryptex.
Sonia made one for me once.
My grandfather gave me a wagon.
That, of course, was The Da Vinci Code, the big screen version of the international best-selling book by Dan Brown. It's the kind of success publishers dream about, and today they're dreaming very big indeed. The Lost Symbol is Dan Brown's follow-up book. It comes out next Tuesday at a time when the publishing industry needs a big win after a very tough year. One good sign for the business? The book is already the number one book on Amazon.com, and it hasn't even been published yet. Motoko Rich is watching the hype and the growing expectations. She covers publishing for our partner, The New York Times. Motoko, good morning.
Good morning.
So The Da Vinci Code, as a book, sold more than 80 million copies around the world. What kind of expectations do booksellers, realistic expectations, do booksellers have for The Lost Symbol?
Well, it's a good question about what realistic expectations might be. But the publisher, for a start, has printed 5 million copies and is shipping them out sometime this week for the on-sale date of Tuesday. So expectations are extremely high.
And 5 million in the publishing world is where in the scale of is this expected to be a biggie?
Well, if you think of the sort of average, I mean, a good Stephen King or John Grisham will generally sell about 1 million copies total, but the average book sells, you know, 60, 70,000 copies. So 5 million is huge. It's not Harry Potter huge. I think Harry Potter sold something like 12, 13 million in its first 24 hours, first couple of days on sale, but this is big for an adult trade book. Part of the reason is that Dan Brown's last book, The Da Vinci Code, was published in 2003. He promised a follow-up by sometime around 2005, and now we're here in 2009. So the publisher is a little late.
What the heck? So, by the way, quick pricey. What do we know about the story?
We don't know much, but he's told us a little tantalizing details that it features Robert Langdon again, that it's set in Washington, D.C., that it has a lot to do with the Freemasons. So he's given us a few tidbits, and everybody's all across the blogosphere is trying to figure out what it's actually about, and a lot of different writers and publishers are kind of cranking up. So the moment the book comes out and they have a moment opportunity to read it, they're all going to write their own historical and factual backgrounds about it.
And is the idea just to sell this book, or do booksellers have something else in mind when people come in to purchase this one?
Oh, they most definitely have something else in mind. They're hoping that this will really, really kind of light a fire under book buyers. It's been, as you said, a very sluggish year, and so fall is traditionally the big season for booksellers anyway, but this is turning out to be kind of an extraordinary fall. Not only do we have Dan Brown's book coming out, but there are pretty much every big author that you can think of has a book coming out this fall. That week alone, Senator Ted Kennedy's memoir is coming out on Monday. Jon Krakauer has a book coming out. Then John Irving has a book coming out. Stephen King, John Grisham, Barbara Kingsolver, Nick Hornby. I mean, it's just turning out to be this crazy fall of big-name authors putting books out. And so the booksellers are hoping that people might come in to buy the Dan Dan Brown or the Ted Kennedy memoir.
And walk then, out with 12 others in their little pocketbook.
Exactly.
Okay, Motoko Rich covers publishing for our partner, the New York Times. And, you know, if you're going to write a book and if it's not going to be one of these blockbusters, just keep your fingers crossed.
Takes place in Washington, D.C. I haven't seen any of the movie trucks around Washington yet, but I'm sure they'll be there for this.
Oh, they'll be following right along.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Lynn Scher here with Todd Zwillick, and speaking of responsibility, we'll talk about what it means to eat responsibility. Eat responsibly.
Delicious.
That's in a few. No, you don't want to eat responsibility. Responsibly. That's in a few minutes. We are also talking about President Obama's speech before Congress tonight to pitch his health care plan. We're looking for your best 20-second pitch for why a new health care plan should or shouldn't pass. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, some of the news stories we're following this morning. The president says he'll answer all the big questions on health care reform in his speech to Congress tonight. Here's what he told ABC News.
I think what the country is going to know is exactly what I think will solve our health care crisis.
President Obama says he won't be rigid or ideological in his plans, but he wants to get something done this year. In Boston, there's a hearing today on whether to change state law to let the Democratic governor pick a temporary successor to Senator Ted Kennedy. Critics call it a political power grab designed to add enough Senate votes to pass Mr. Obama's health care plan.
Overseas, NATO forces have freed New York Times reporter Stephen Farrell in a dramatic helicopter rescue. He was kidnapped in northern Afghanistan on Saturday. Farrell's Afghan translator and a British commando were killed in the rescue. Staying abroad, Israel says it's pushing ahead with plans to build almost 500 homes in East Jerusalem. It's another rebuff to the U.S., which has said Israel must stop all settlements. Back in the U.S., a White House panel says NASA's plans to send a manned mission to the moon and Mars are not viable. Retired astronaut Leroy Chiao says NASA doesn't have the money.
The fact is that when the vision for space exploration was first announced in 2004, there was an expectation of a certain budget level. Those numbers have not been realized.
The panel says unless NASA gets billions more in cash, they will have to partner with private companies for some projects. And those are some of the stories we're watching.
Wednesday, and that means we are talking about food. And lately, we've all learned the buzzwords about responsible eating.
Organic ingredients.
Being in tune with the plant.
Sustainability and biodiversity.
Eating locally raised meat.
Every product is local to some place.
Well, what about those messages? Eat organics, eat locally. Are they really the answer? To find out, we turn to James McWilliams, Associate Professor of History at Texas State University and author of Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. We're also joined by Victor Davis Hansen. Victor is a former California raisin farmer who currently owns a raisin farm in California. I love raisins. He is also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institute. Welcome to both of you. And James McWilliams, let me start with you. This sounds like heresy. Local food movement, not so much?
Well, no. I mean, I draw some fine lines in my book, and I certainly support the local food movement, and I certainly support the organic movement, and I just think that they're part of the answer rather than the answer. So I'm trying to warn and provide something of a corrective against what I see as a creeping fundamentalism about eating local or eating organic, and just trying to remind readers that there's room for there's room for more voices in this debate, and achieving sustainable agriculture is really going to require a more global perspective in many cases, and also a portfolio approach. We're going to need many solutions working together at once. So,
let's get specific.
A bit of a middle of the road.
Let's get specific here. How can, for example, an imported tomato actually be more energy efficient than a local greenhouse tomato?
Well, the important thing to do, I think, is, as consumers, is to start thinking less about transportation and more about how the tomato was produced. And, you know, there are a number of life cycle assessment studies out there that show that, you know, if you go ahead and buy something local, but it's grown in a hothouse, say a tomato that's grown in a hothouse, you have to take into consideration the energy that was required to produce that tomato, and it can outweigh the energy that would cost the transportation to send it from somewhere else where it was produced under natural conditions. So it's really the production phase of food that we need to pay more attention to rather than, you know, the food miles and the food miles alone. That's not to say we need to ignore the food miles, but we need to remember that how this food was produced involves more than just transportation.
Victor Davis Hansen out in California, you're a farmer, but you say farming is romanticized in our culture. Was there ever a really golden age of farming and kind of a pure time for the farmers?
I think there was up until World War II, but it was a very brutal time. I mean, the world that my grandparents and parents in their early lives grew up in was 10 and 12 hours a day, and it was made much easier in a devil's bargain with the introduction of tractors and organophosphate chemicals and the whole bureaucracy of government. So it was a much simpler time in the 1920s and 30s, but people got up. I remember my grandfather telling me that half of his ranch, the farm that I now own, it was a little larger then, was used just to produce pasture, just to produce food for the horses to farm the rest of the farm, which was grapes. One thing about local food, though, I mean, we can talk about tomatoes, but that's not the end of the story. You can't have local grapes or local nectarines or local plums because they won't grow in a greenhouse. So that people, it's also a question about choice. So if somebody is living in Michigan or in Wisconsin in January, they're not going to be able to have fresh grapes or fresh plums. So if people believe in localism, and I agree that the goals are noble, then they have to realize that they're going to have to curtail their choice a little bit. They're going to have to say, for ideological reasons or environmental reasons or labor reasons or whatever reasons they are, I choose not to have a fresh plum, pretty flat fresh, sent in from Chile, or I do not want to have grapes sent in from Mexico.
So that's
I'm
about
only going to eat out of. I'm only going to eat in season.
That's about consumers managing some of their own expectations.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is Todd Zwillick, Victor. Do you think that what James calls sort of the creeping fundamentalism of local-grown organic food, does that have something to do with a kind of sort of a fetishization of farm culture and farm life, you know, farmers in overalls and straw hats? Do you feel that at all, or do you think there's...
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think James made a good point that the farmer that we knew, when we use the word family farmer, that is a couple with children that live in a house that's a homestead. Their primary income is through agriculture alone. They're not part of a corporate infrastructure. They're not vertically integrated. They're very rare now. And so the people who think they inherited that romance are usually people from the city, very bright people, very capable, that are very intensive organic farmers, and who make a pretty good living going, selling 10% of California's fresh fruit that's consumed every day in farmers' markets. But it's a different paradigm, and I don't think necessarily socially or politically or economically they have much in common with the romance of the early 20th century farmer.
Well, romance aside, it seems to me that the conversation about getting the consumer to make a few, shall we say, sacrifices and not be quite so greedy and not be used to having everything all the time whenever you want it makes more sense. James McWilliams, what other things can we as eaters, as residents on this planet do not to go crazy, not to be fundamentalist, but to sort of get back to basics?
Well, yeah, there's an element of frustration here when we look at production and ask ourselves questions about food production because we know very little. And when we pick up, you know, something in the grocery store, we really have very little knowledge about how it was produced. So, you know, Victor's point about the romanticization is, I think, a really important one, because if we get pulled into the romantic vision of the local system, what we forget is that we can have a much greater impact on the environment. We can lower the carbon footprint of our diet by eating the right kinds of foods rather than necessarily worrying about where our food came from. And the argument that I really push in my book is that the closer we become to The closer we move to a vegetarian diet, the lower our carbon footprint will become. So I really advise against getting terribly worked up over where our plum came from or where our apricot came from or tomato or apple came from, and focus on the fact that if you're buying lots of fruits and vegetables and eating lots of fruits and vegetables, legumes and nuts, the carbon footprint of your diet is going to go down dramatically. And, you know, just by giving up, if the average meat eater gave up meat once a week, that would be the equivalent of eating all of your food local.
James McWilliams, Associate Professor of History at Texas State University and author of Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. And Victor Davis Hanson, a former California raisin farmer. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
So tonight, the president goes before Congress to pitch his health plan. It's going to be a tough sell. Maybe he needs some advice.
If he goes for a message that is truly straightforward, simple, clear, and honest, that's the best he can do.
That's your takeaway from advertising consultant Cindy Gallup with her tip on how the president can best sell his plan. We're also looking for your best 20-second pitch on why a new health plan should or should not pass.
This is DJ calling from New Jersey. Please, listeners, regarding the health care bill, don't expect perfection. That will never, never happen. Everyone has to compromise.
We want your take at 1-877-8-MYTAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything today, we're always online at thetakeaway.org, and you can download our podcast on iTunes. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm Lynn Scherr, and this is The Takeaway. The president makes his case for health care tonight. What do you need to hear from him to be convinced?
Good morning, Troy calling from Dakota. I think one of the big stumbling blocks is the price tag. I have a hard time getting past that.
Still undecided on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 9th. I'm Todd Zwillick, joined by Lynn Scherr. We're filling in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Lynn.
Morning, Todd.
Well, coming up this hour, the psychology and cash behind rapper Jay-Z. Hillary the movie is back for another round in Supreme Court. And then Wall Street's got a sweet tooth why cookies and candy are leading the economic recovery.
But first, Faith Dow in San Francisco, California. You're an Obama supporter. You do not have health insurance. What specifically do you want the president to address tonight to get the votes he needs?
I would like the president to put single payer back on the table, and I especially want guaranteed coverage, the same type of coverage that members of Congress have. I had a high quality PPO plan, but the cost was around $700 a month. I need a low cost, comprehensive plan that encourages preventative care, not just sick care.
Faith Dow, stay with us. We will be back with you in just a moment, but first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines this morning, the White House says the president will answer all major questions on health reform tonight, including how to pay for covering millions of uninsured Americans. The GOP response to that address will come from Louisiana representative and physician Charles Bustani. Overseas, NATO forces have freed New York Times reporter Stephen Farrell, who was kidnapped in northern Afghanistan on Saturday. Bill Keller, editor of our partner, The New York Times, described the rescue.
They were in a house under the Taliban guard. They heard the helicopters. Everybody ran for it, and we still don't know exactly who shot whom and what went on.
Farrell's Afghan translator and a British commando were killed in that rescue.
Markets were up just under 1% yesterday. The Dow opens this hour at 94.97. The S&P starts trading at 10.25. And tonight, as we've been telling you, President Obama goes before Congress to pitch his health care plan. We're looking for your best 20-second pitch for why a new health care plan should or shouldn't pass.
My name is Joe, and I believe that something has to keep the big insurance companies in check, and the only way to do that currently is with a government-run alternative, which will put a floor on prices.
So what do you think? Tell us at 877-8-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Now, Lynn, I sort of have my own 20-second pitch on healthcare,
if you don't mind. I'm listening.
Well, I'm going to be in Detroit this evening. The Takeaway is participating in a town hall on healthcare. It's being thrown by WDET Detroit, which is the public radio station there and one of our Takeaway stations. It's a chance for listeners and anyone else in the community to come out and get their questions answered. I'll be on the panel. There's a local politician on the panel, some healthcare experts and professors. So a good chance for people to come out and get their questions on this complex issue answered. It's being thrown by Wayne State University. It's being held at Wayne State, and you can get more information on wayne.edu. And don't worry about missing the president's speech. They're going to show it in the room right after we're done.
And tomorrow, perhaps you'll come on the air and tell us how it went.
I'm counting on it.
Okay.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. On this Wednesday morning, I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here with Lynn Scher. We're both here for John Hockenberry. We're looking ahead to President Obama's big health care address before Congress this evening. We want to know, what's your take?
Hi, this is Ken Dolan Del Vecchio in Morristown, New Jersey. I think the challenge before the president is to decide whether he stands with the 70%+ of Americans who want a national health care system, want all Americans covered, or is he going to stand with those corporations? That's the challenge.
All right, so we're looking for your best 20-second pitch, some people call it the elevator pitch, for why a new health care plan should or should not pass. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us your email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, we're here with Cheryl Gay-Stolberg. Cheryl is White House correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, experienced Capitol Hill reporter, not to mention White House correspondent. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Cheryl, your article this morning in the Times is a lot more optimistic than the other stuff that people have been writing that I've been writing and reporting about this healthcare debate. You say there's not just light at the end of the tunnel, but there's plenty of light in the tunnel for the president and Democrats to get this done.
Well, what I say is that the conventional wisdom is that, you know, his health care bill is on life support and that it would take a miracle to revive it, but that, in fact, the conventional wisdom might be wrong. Now, that's not to say, Todd, that there's not huge challenges ahead for the president. This could really blow up at any time. But the fact of the matter is that there are a few pieces in place for him. Healthcare industry players like the pharmaceutical companies, the hospitals, the doctors, the insurers are still at the negotiating table, even after this raucous August. The public does not seem to have changed its mood that much. Support has dipped, it's true, but still 60% of the public, surprisingly, in a recent CBS poll, supports the public option, the most controversial element of the plan. And that there's still broad agreement within the Democratic Party, even though there are tensions between moderates and liberals, there's broad agreement about what a package would look like. And the fact of the matter is that four of the five committees considering health legislation have already passed bills. Now, that's not to say, again, that there's not a long way to go. I'm just saying the plan is not dead in the water.
And as they get close to voting time, or at least closer to voting time, what about the attitude amongst the people who have to vote on this stuff? Most people have written off House Republicans completely. They look towards the Senate. Is there any hope, do you think, for getting to magical 60? Is there any hope for bringing a couple of Republicans on board here?
Well, I think people are correct to write off House Republicans, but the fact of the matter is that Democrats control the House and they can pass a bill without Republican support. The president says he wants bipartisanship, and he's trying in the Senate, and there are a few prospects. Senator Olympia Snow of Maine is one. Her colleague in Maine, Susan Collins, although not active in this debate, I think is another likely contender. And there's some new indications that some other Republicans, maybe even Senator George Voinovich of Ohio, who's been a swing vote in the past, might be in play.
And, so, who doesn't have to run for reelection because he's retiring.
Right. That's right. And you know, is the president likely to get overwhelming bipartisan support for this bill? No. But what he needs to pass the Senate is 60 votes. And he has a shot at getting 60 votes. And if he doesn't get 60, he could use the legislative maneuver known as reconciliation, which would allow a bill to pass with 50 votes, although it's more complicated to do it that way.
And a lot of folks around the Senate call that the nuclear option because of what it would do to relationships between Senator Cheryl Stolberg from the New York Times. Before I let you go, I want to ask you just one more question about some of the specifics. Now that the chairman of the Finance Committee Max Baucus has released his proposal. You mentioned Senator Olympia Snow as one of the sort of bridgers here, one of the compromisers. She has talked about sort of a trigger. Yes, we can have a public option, but only in the future if other reforms fail and costs don't come down. Baucus didn't mention that. Is that idea still in play here?
It's a good question, but, you know, that's an idea that not only appeals to Senator Snow, but also a wavering Democrat, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, has said he would contemplate that. So even though Baucus didn't mention it, we all know that this bill is, like all the other bills that have passed, is a starting point. And it's possible to see a compromise emerging around the trigger. Liberals don't like it. Advocates of a public option, a strong public option, don't want it. But I think faced with a bill or no bill, those people might go for it.
All right. Cheryl Stolberg of the New York Times, White House correspondent and experienced healthcare reporter, thanks for joining us to bring us up to speed. We appreciate it. Of course, the president speaks before Congress and senators and members of the public tonight. There are also thousands of ordinary Americans who will be watching, and many of them are still unconvinced that the president has arrived at the best solution for health reform. And we have two such people with us right now. Brad Bynum is a landscape architect from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. He gave up health insurance a year ago when he left his job for a position with higher pay, but has no health benefits. Brad is a registered Republican. Faith Dow, who you heard in our opening, is a freelance writer from San Francisco. She doesn't have health insurance, but she voted for President Obama. Brad, is there anything the president can say tonight when you'll be watching that will convince you that health reform is needed now and that he has the right recipe?
Well, I think the basic thing is something clear cut, and that seems to be the problem, is that you hear all these different options of co-op or this or that, and there's not a clear cut solution of what the direction that he wants to take and wants to go.
Well, let me ask you about that, Brad.
That'll make it work.
Let me ask you about that real quick, because you want clear cut, and I certainly understand that, but healthcare is, as I know, is unbelievably complex. We have a million different programs and insurance companies all over the map. Is it a little bit too much to expect, do you think, for any politician to be able to make it simple and clear cut when it's such a morass to begin with?
I think you can take the basics of what you want and outline the basics. And I think that's one of the fears that I have, too, is that if you just get a basic bill in there and then everybody starts adding on to critique it, then you have special interest and it becomes a monster. And that's, you know, I would at least like to know which direction he wants to go with it and try to outline the way that he would like to see it done so that I can compare it to what we have.
Now, Brad, you don't have health insurance. Do you feel like you need it right now?
Oh, absolutely. I had a lack of health insurance once before, and it ended up costing me my house.
All right. Faith Dow, freelance writer in San Francisco and a Democrat, you also don't have health insurance. Are you more inclined to sign on to what the president wants to do? Why are you skeptical?
I'm skeptical for the same reasons as our Republican friend outlined. There's too much being left open to interpretation and nothing concrete. And insurance companies are notorious for finding reasons to deny coverage of people even after you've paid premiums. So I would like to see something that holds them accountable and that offers coverage to people without limitations.
So you want the president to clearly say that his plan will have no denial of coverage for pre-existing conditions, no rescission, they can't cancel your plan if you get sick?
Yes.
And Faith, let me ask you, what's your current situation? You don't have health insurance. Do you feel like you need it, or are you missing out on care right now?
I'm not missing out on care, but the feeling of wondering if something bad happened, what would one do, is there. So I would like to have coverage again. Through my former employer, it was $700 a month, and I can't maintain that cost myself.
Faith and Brad, it's Lynn Scher here. Let's do our own little mini poll about what the outcome is going to be. Does either of you believe you're going to get the answers you want tonight, and does either of you believe this program is going to pass?
I believe it'll probably pass, and what I would like to hear tonight is, like I said, we don't even know which direction, if he wants to go national, if he wants to go co-op, if, you know, and whether I believe that I'm going to get the answer tonight is, I think he's been working on it, but I'll just have to wait and see.
Faith, you think it's going to happen?
I'm skeptical, quite frankly. We'll see what happens.
Brad, I want to ask you real quick, just because your situation there in Oklahoma, you've got two senators who are both Republicans, Tom Coburn, who's a physician, and James Inhofe. They have both been sort of reflexively against anything that the Democrats have brought to the table. Do you support that, or have you been skeptical of your own senators who haven't really been coming to the table on this? Real quick.
Well, actually, I'm rather disappointed in all of the bipartisan. In other words, if I take a stand and this falls on its face, then I look good type mentality. And I respect what he tried to do in the beginning. In other words, here's what I want to do. You guys work out something, and that hasn't worked. Mm-hmm. So he has to step in and say, here's what I want to do. I want the people behind me. If he explains that clearly, fine. But yes, I do get tired of voting just because it's one way or the other. We need to do the right thing.
All right. Will the president's speech change undecided voters' minds? Listen tomorrow. We're going to check in with Brad Bynum and Faith Dow on tomorrow's show to find out if the president's speech changed their minds. Also, I'll be on the show tomorrow morning, but from Detroit, after having watched the president's speech and participating in a town hall thrown by WDET Detroit tonight, we'll find out what people at that town hall thought of the president's speech and about health reform.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Yeah, I'm up at Brooklyn, now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow, but I'll be hood forever, I'm Sinatra, and since I made it here, I can make it anywhere, yeah, they love me everywhere, I used to cop in Harlem, all of my Dominican.
That's Empire State of Mind from right here in New York. It's a cut from Blueprint 3, the 11th studio album from rapper Jay-Z, which was rushed to stores yesterday after being leaked online. Forbes estimates that Jay-Z, the rapper behind such classic hip-hop songs as Dirt Off Your Shoulder and Hard Knock Life, rakes in about $82 million a year. Granted, a lot of that has to do with his former day job as CEO over at Def Jam and, of course, is the owner of the New Jersey Nets NBA team. But mostly the world knows Jay-Z as a hit maker and record seller. Well, joining us now is David Wall Rice, diehard Jay-Z fan, professor of psychology at Morehouse College. David is author of the book, I Ain't No Joke, Identity Negotiations Through the Narratives of Hip Hop. Welcome back to the show, David.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So, Identity Negotiations Through the Narratives of Hip Hop lyricism. What's the narrative of Jay-Z's lyricism? He was talking about on Empire State of Mind. He talks about, I know we're facing a recession, but the music y'all are making going to make it the Great Depression. It's one of my favorite lines he's come out with in years. What's the narrative in his lyricism, do you think?
Right. Well, that's death of autotunes. And I think that the narrative that Jay-Z provides is really it's a snapshot of the American dream. I think that, in writing the text that I'm currently working on, the interesting thing is to look at hip-hop music largely as Ralph Ellison's ultimate invisible man. Oftentimes, the pageantry is there. We see the imagery of black males and we see them on videos and whatnot, but rarely are the narratives taken into consideration. And I think that Jay-Z is very unique in that he's able to push a narrative in front of us through, the expression of his authenticity and vulnerability that really allows a unique access here, 11 albums deep.
It's also interesting for a guy to whom image has been so important. He's never had, sort of a classic hip-hop thug image so much, but he's been a clothing marketer and a huge marketer as well, so image has been important to his career.
Sure. No, absolutely. I think that, anytime you're going to make space and guerrilla your way into popular culture, imagery is going to be important. I think that what's coupled with that imagery is also very important and unique with respect to how Jay-Z has managed to frame himself and remain relevant over these past several years.
All right, you mentioned the death of autotune, which I want to bring up now. We want to listen to that a little bit. Sort of a dissonant track and syncopatic track from Jay-Z. Let's give it a listen.
Hold up. Only rap
paper to rewrite history without a pen. No ID on the track, let the story begin.
All right, that's the death of autotune. You watch the video, Jay-Z's blowing up those classic hip-hop symbols of gold ropes and stuff like that, and sweatsuits and everything. What do you think Jay-Z's going for here?
Well, I think clearly what he's going for there in kind of leaning on the imagery of classic hip-hop, Cristal bottles, and you know, most notably the autotune mixing that allows for people to modulate their voices. I think that what he's trying to do is push against a lot of the popularization and the vanilla-ing of current hip-hop expressions, and what he seems to be talking about in this particular narrative is kind of bringing it back to the authenticity of pushing against, of being, you know, kind of a clarion call for what's going on with marginalized youth and whatnot. And then he's also talking about, you know, gangster hard thugganism.
He takes a swipe at T-Pain, I think, in that track. Is he taking a swipe at like Lil Wayne and people like that, who use sort of a vocoder kind of autotune type of synthesis in their voices and sort of that vinylization you're talking about?
I think that what he's doing more than anything, I mean, certainly he has said that he wasn't really looking at T-Pain in particular or Lil Wayne or Kanye West, who executive produced the current album, The Blueprint 3, that he wasn't taking a swipe at individuals who are using it in an artistic way. What he is saying is that if everybody who's putting out an album has the vocoder on them, then it becomes, you know, what's unique about it. So I think he's all about it. It appears that he's all about artistic expression. I think that this turn that he takes on the Blueprint 3 and previously, quite frankly, on Kingdom Come, looks at him as pushing the genre of hip hop closer and closer to music that's more acceptable and mainstream.
You know, as a political guy myself, a political journalist, but also a music lover, I've been amazed, especially with this album, having given it a listen last night and over the last couple of days, that Jay-Z has managed to keep that authenticity you're talking about, even while getting involved in politics to some degree. You know, he got close to the Obamas, was involved in the campaign, but hasn't really become sort of a commercial of himself in the process.
Right. He's managed not to become a commercial or a caricature of himself. And I think that also speaks to the authenticity, which we referenced early on. You know, if you're able to kind of operate with some type of integrity and honesty, I think that it's interesting what he has been able to and what's suggested to others, what they're able to do. You know, you're able to kind of hold on to what it is that you believe in. And as long as you do that, you can kind of be acceptable in different contexts.
Right.
So it's interesting to look at his personality.
Well, the President of the United States has heard the track Dirt Off Your Shoulder. Apparently it's on his iPod. Let's give the President a listen here real quick.
So I understand it. And when you're running for the presidency, then you've got to expect it. And, you know, you've just got to kind of let it, you know, that's what you got to do. That's what you got to do.
You got to get that dirt off your shoulder. Just to describe some of the audio that you heard, the president, when he's just brushing his shoulder. You got to brush it off your shoulder. I remember the president seeing Jay-Z on stage and giving him that little brush.
Right. Yeah. I think that, you know, that's amazing. I mean, you bring that into the popular space, and that's something that's televised, and, you know, he's visually name-checked and all that. And I think that, you know, it shows an access that an individual is able to gain with power, you know, an access to power. And seeing him, you know, at the inauguration with his huge fuzzy fur hat on and all that kind of stuff, that stuff makes a difference to folks who have followed him over these years and has seen somebody go from the proverbial rags to riches.
All right, Jay-Z's new album is called The Blueprint 3. David Wall Rice is author of the forthcoming book, I Ain't No Joke, Identity Negotiation Through the Narrative of Hip-Hop Lyricism. You can read David's blog post titled Jay-Z Grows Up on thetakeaway.org. Thanks for joining us, David. And now let's take a look at today's news headlines.
Todd, the president makes his case for health care tonight in a speech before the joint session of Congress. The speech is scheduled for 8 o'clock Eastern Time. In northern Afghanistan, NATO special forces have rescued Stephen Farrell, a kidnapped New York Times journalist from the Taliban. One of Farrell's Afghan colleagues and a British soldier were killed in the rescue. In California, crews will try again today to set backfires in an effort to slow the progress of the wildfire in a forest near L.A.
Coming up, what does the documentary about Hillary Clinton have to do with changing campaign finance laws? We'll find out in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Lynn Scherr in with Todd Zwillick for John Hockenberry. Hillary goes to the Supreme Court today. That's Hillary the Movie, a sort of documentary film that describes the former First Lady in a very negative light. And today's hearing might become a precedent-setting case with the power to change campaign finance laws in a way that hasn't happened in 100 years. In case you missed it, here is a clip from the flick with Dick Morris, a former Clinton advisor.
You know, a lot of people ask me, do we have to go through all these old Clinton scandals again? Well, I have good news for you. You don't, because you can look at the new ones, because Hillary Clinton scandals are a gift that keeps on giving.
Okay, so what does a movie have to do with campaign finance? And why is this case being brought for the second time before the Supreme Court? How might it change the law books? Joining us now are Adam Liptak and Nate Persily. Adam Liptak is the Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Nate Persily, a law professor at Columbia University. He is author of the book Public Opinion and Constitutional Controversy. Welcome to both of you. And Adam, let me start with you. How might this movie change campaign finance?
The Supreme Court has set down this case for re-argument, quite unusual in itself, and asked the parties to brief the question of whether a key precedent that allows the government to regulate corporate spending on campaigns, whether that precedent should be overturned. And if it is, we're going to see a radical change in the way American politics is conducted, because corporations will be free to spend money on ads and other broadcast communications supporting or opposing political candidates.
Nate Persily, this case was first heard before the Supreme Court last March. Why are they rehearing it, and how significant is that?
Well, as Adam said, it's unusual for them to do this. They've only done it a few times in recent history. And I think that the reason they're doing so is that the government, when it defended the law, seemed to suggest sort of radical powers on the part of government, for example, to ban corporate books. And that, I think, triggered among some of the justices maybe a willingness to revisit the more fundamental questions as to whether corporations have First Amendment rights to advocate for the election or defeat of candidates. I think that the Roberts Court has been relatively incremental when it comes to all of the campaign finance laws that it has struck down, and it has struck down every law that it has visited during its short tenure dealing with campaign finance. But I think maybe now they're willing to go a little bit further and have a much more broad precedent.
Adam Liptak, let's sort this out for listeners, because it is confusing. The ruling would make it possible for more of these kinds of films to be out there. Is that correct?
That's correct. But really, the film, it would be quite easy for the court to protect this 90-minute documentary. The case really now is not about 90-minute documentaries. It's about 30-second ads. And the question is whether the 2002 McCain-Feingold campaign finance law, which prohibits the broadcast of some so-called electioneering communications right before elections, whether that's constitutional or not. And if the court were to rule in favor of this movie broadly, it would also be ruling that corporations are free to put up ads supporting or opposing candidates. And given the size of corporate treasuries, that could really alter the political landscape.
And that would be very much counter to what McCain-Feingold was all about, correct?
It would in fact not only be counter to, but it would be striking down at least part of McCain-Feingold. That's right.
One of the things that's happened with this film is... and this case is the very curious lineup of liberals and conservatives and which side of the issue they're on. Talk about that a little bit, Adam.
Well, it used to be a generation ago that the typical liberal would be a First Amendment absolutist and would say, the First Amendment is about protecting political speech. The core of the First Amendment is about making sure that people can listen to arguments about political speech, and this is surely that, whatever else Hillary the Movie is. It's political speech. As time has gone on, the left has become divided, and a significant, probably overwhelming part of the left now believes that it's more important to protect the level playing field in political discourse and not to allow one side or the other with the most money to overwhelm the conversation.
So the issue of free speech has gotten caught up in the issue of who gets to finance these things.
Right. So on the one hand, you have the First Amendment. On the other hand, you have an interest in protecting democracy itself.
Nate Persily, let's talk about the court for a second. I want to say to you, how are they going to vote? I know you don't know for sure how they're going to vote, but what is going to happen, do you think, in this case?
Well, I think they're going to find in favor of the appellants, those people who produced the Hillary the movie. The question is how broad the relief is going to be. As Adam said, there's all kinds of ways they could avoid the broader issues in this case, and they could say, for example, that whatever McCain-Feingold was about, it wasn't about a 90-minute documentary that you could view on demand. Or they could say Citizens United, the group that made this movie, is not like General Motors, so that we don't really have to worry about them using their immense aggregations of wealth to sort of affect elections. My guess is that it's really up to Chief Justice Roberts. This is one of those rare instances where he might be the swing vote, and he's going to decide how broad a decision he wants.
Give me the worst-case scenario from the point of view of, say, the liberals or whichever side they're now on in terms of it's been mentioned books could be banned depending on the ruling.
Well, Congress would have to pass a law banning books, and we're a long way from there. So the Supreme Court's not going to give anyone the right to ban books. But the government has said that Congress, at least hypothetically, theoretically, could do that, that there's no distinction in principle between Hillary the movie and Hillary the book. The worst-case scenario, I think, on the other side for a lot of people would be the notion that, say, in the current health care debate, Big Pharma sits down across from a senator, and that senator feels like he's talking to someone with a loaded gun because that company could put up $10 million of ads against them in the next election if the senator doesn't vote the way the company wants him to.
Adam Liptak, you've actually seen the film. Is this the sort of thing that we want in our campaigns?
It's a polemical, relentlessly critical look at Hillary Clinton. It's not out of keeping with the sort of thing that, since the founding of the Republic, we've seen in the political discourse. It's caustic, and it's a little hard to know how to distinguish it from the kinds of political speech that not too long ago there was a general consensus ought to be protected.
So the takeaway is this is a big case before the Supreme Court, and it could change the law. Adam Liptak from The Times, Nate Persily from Columbia, thanks so much for joining us. Now let's take a look at the headlines.
Tonight, President Obama addresses a joint session of Congress to talk health care. In the speech, the president said he will clarify his plans for reforming the system. The speech is scheduled for 8 p.m. Eastern Time. In northern Afghanistan, NATO special forces have rescued kidnapped New York Times reporter Stephen Farrell from the Taliban. One of Farrell's Afghan colleagues and a British soldier were killed in that rescue. Staying overseas, Israel said it's pushing ahead with delayed plans to build almost 500 more homes for Jewish settlers in East Jerusalem. The move may stall efforts to restart peace talks. The U.S. has asked Israel to stop all settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories as a good faith measure towards Palestinians. And those are some of the top stories we're watching today. All this week, we're looking back on a year of the financial crisis. Coming up, the crash of Lehman Brothers and what to take away from its demise. It's coming up in 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Lynn Scherr. Swine flu, or H1N1, it's got the medical world working overtime. Ever since the flu strain first appeared in April in Mexico, scientists and pharmaceutical companies around the globe have been gearing up to develop and mass produce a vaccine. The Obama administration has ordered 195 million doses of vaccine, but we're still waiting for a mass vaccination program. Well, one country doesn't have to wait any longer. This week, China became the first country in the world to start a mass vaccination program. Sharong Chen is China editor for our partners, the BBC, and he joins us now. Welcome. Sharong, why is China the first country to mass vaccinate against swine flu?
Well, we know China a few years back, they had the SARS epidemic and they learned lessons from that. So they really geared up to get this H1N1 vaccination ready. So the equivalent of FDA in China approved mass production only on Monday, and the vaccination program start this week.
So it went through a lot faster than ours, but there is, we understand, a rather curious political twist to this program. Can you talk about that a little bit?
That's right. Well, contrary to what the U.S. can do, the U.S. has ordered over 100 million doses. In China, the first order is only around 7 million doses. And the priority, they have a criteria, priority list, the vulnerable people, like the young kids between 5 to 19 and the those with respiratory diseases and heart diseases and so on. And also the frontline public service personnel. Similar cases as in the U.S., the Chinese authorities say, well, you need to vaccinate the doctors and nurses before they can serve the people infected. But this end of this month, 1st of October, China would see the biggest celebration the People's Republic has ever seen in the past 60 years.
This is the National Day Parade?
That's right, in Beijing. So there would be around 500,000 participants waving flags, singing songs and flowers and so on and so forth. And also the public security personnel, the police, the soldiers and so on and so forth. So they decided it's this group of people who should be vaccinated first.
So they are being vaccinated first, the people who are going to be at this parade. And why is that? Is that because they might have exposure with some of the officials?
Well, the justification is, of course, this is a public event, probably by far the biggest one. So they should get vaccinated so that the people wouldn't pass germs, the virus, from one to the other. And, of course, we know all the central government leaders and party bosses and dignitaries will be around in Beijing. So any eventuality that swine flu virus being passed on through the paraders to the leaders, that would be a political disaster.
So the takeaway is that if we want to get that vaccine out there, we need a big parade here in the States, right? Xirong Chen is China editor for our partner, the BBC. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about swine flu.
You just give them shots as they walk by with the bass drums and the trumpets. Just as they walk by, you have people and just stick, stick, stick.
I think it's a spray. I think you just get that spray
a
going.
A fine mist.
A very fine mist. And like the old polio spray. That's what we need.
Much more efficient.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Todd Zwillick here with Lynn Scher. It's been 1 year since the economic collapse, and coming up, we'll take a look at the demise of one of the big players in it, Lehman Brothers. That's coming up in a few minutes. We're also talking about the president's speech before Congress tonight to pitch his health care plan. We're looking for your best 20-second pitch on why a new health care plan should or shouldn't pass.
If Obama thinks he can reform health care without tort reform, he's just showing himself to be a typical politician.
Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE. Send us email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, some of the news stories that we're following this morning. NATO forces have freed New York Times reporter Stephen Farrell, who was kidnapped in northern Afghanistan on Saturday. Farrell's Afghan translator and a British commander were killed in that rescue. Bill Keller, editor of the New York Times, told The Takeaway that the Afghan countryside is getting more unstable for journalists.
The situation has gotten more and more perilous. You know, we've set up new protocols for reporters traveling out in the field, and we're going to take another look at those now to find out whether they're strict enough.
Farrell was the second Times reporter to be captured this year.
Overseas, Iran gives new proposals on its nuclear program to members of the UN Security Council today. That's as the U.S. says it has serious concerns that Iran will try to keep an option open for building nuclear weapons. The World Bank has once again named Singapore as the easiest place to do business. Next on the list, Hong Kong and New Zealand. The World Bank ranks countries on the cost of starting a business, trade, and taxes. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
All right, thanks, Lynn. Could Trident gum and Oreos lead the way to a Wall Street recovery? About Velveeta cheese and fluff, maybe. If Kraft Foods is able to work out a deal to buy the British candy company Cadbury. Kraft offered $16.7 billion for Cadbury on Monday. The offer was quickly rejected, but there's more to this story than the backroom dealing between food companies. But before we get into this, by the way, I should mention that my sister does some promotions in commercials for Kraft Foods. Not that I get any benefit from it, Lynn, but I just thought I'd disclose that since we're talking about Kraft
Foods
here.
Very honest of you, very transparent.
Yes, indeed. Maybe it should benefit me. I'll give her a call after this. Well, we're joined now by Louise Story, a Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, two gigantic processed food companies merging for $17 billion. This is a good news story?
Well, it's a lot of money, and we haven't seen mega deals happening because the markets have been closed. What's really notable about this is that we're hearing rumors that there's some banks like Citigroup and Deutsche Bank that might be willing to lend money to Kraft to make this acquisition go through. And that's what's been drives the lending. So if we've got the banks back helping companies acquire their companies, could be a real sign of progress.
So nothing particular to Kraft or Cadbury, but just the fact that they're doing the deal and that banks are willing to put up the cash.
Right. Banks are willing to put up some cash to lend. Another thing that is notable, though, is that this is a deal where we're not seeing private equity bidders. So when we saw big ticket deals before the financial crisis started, you had a KKR in there, you had a Blackstone, and they were competing with all the corporate buyers. But this is a deal where we're talking about blue chip companies, Kraft, we're talking about Hershey's maybe coming in, making counterbid, Nestle. Because banks are willing to lend to companies. They're not really willing to lend to private equity again yet.
Now, why is the way this deal is financed is also some good news, not only where the money's coming from, but how the deal might be structured. What's the good news there?
Well, a lot of the deal is in stock, but there would be a large cash component. They're saying about $6 billion. But again, I think what's notable is if you can get the banks to lend to you to do a deal, that means the banks are back in business a little. And so that's what people are looking at.
So what's the takeaway here that Kraft and Cadbury are sort of holding the lantern and leading us out of the woods here, the economic crisis?
Well, you know, they say people eat more candy when the economy goes down because they're depressed. And so maybe it is the candy that has to lead us forward.
All right. Louise Story, business reporter for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us to talk about Kraft and Cadbury.
Our system basically failed its most fundamental tests. It was too fragile, too vulnerable to shocks.
We're going to have to save those banks.
Save those banks.
Save those banks.
Even if we cash out the guys that took the big bonuses.
When they fail, they get a bonus. The taxpayer gets the bill.
All week long, we are marking the one-year anniversary of the financial collapse that began on Wall Street and spread across the globe. And today, we focus on the $600 billion collapse of Lehman Brothers, the largest bankruptcy filing in U.S. history. It is a moment that many believe sparked the global economic crisis. We turn now to Lehman Brothers insider Lawrence McDonald. He explores the downfall of Lehman Brothers in his book, A Colossal Failure of Common Sense, the inside story of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. From 2004 to 2008, he served as vice president of distressed debt and convertible securities at Lehman. We're also with Louise Story, who is still with us. Louise, of course, is a finance and Wall Street reporter for our partner, The New York Times, and she will give us a sense of what went down on Wall Street the day that the Lehman Brothers went bust. Let me start with you, Lawrence. In your book, you basically blame the collapse on the guys at the top. Bring us back to those last years and talk about the forces that you think were behind the meltdown.
Well, you know, so many people and first of all, it's great to be here. I've been a fan of yours for years. And, you know, so many people out there in our audience felt last fall they got hit with a sledgehammer over the top of the head. Credit lines were slashed on credit cards. 401ks became 201ks. And, you know, it wasn't a sledgehammer. It was an investment bank. I mean, this failure hurt so many of our listeners out there.
By the way, me.
Yes.
Just talk about full disclosure here. I was a Lehman client, and so I want to know who to be angriest at.
I would be very angry. I mean, there's really two crimes here. Lehman Brothers was put in a horrible, horrible position by some people up in one of the most mysterious places on Earth, that 31st floor at Lehman Brothers. It really is the genesis. A lot of the problems in the financial crisis revolve around these type of places on Wall Street.
The 31st floor was
the executive suite at Lehman Brothers.
And who was running the show?
Richard Fold, Joseph Gregory, a number of people that, you know, Lehman Brothers was never rotten at the core. That's where all the beauty was. She was really rotten at the head. One of the things I'm most proud of is, I mean, I spoke to 45 managing directors, 150 people up and down the firm. I've got 5,000 friends on Facebook and Twitter, over 1,000 of which are Lehman people. And the one thing that I've learned as I peeled back the onion in this project is there was a horrifying disconnect between the trading floor, you know, the trading floors, the second, third, and fourth floors, and that 31st floor. There
but
was a big disconnect.
You did not interview Dick Fold, Richard Fold, who was the head of Lehman Brothers at the time, but you heard a lot of things. Just briefly, sum up for me. What are the headlines that you heard?
You know, these financial, 21st century financial weapons of mass destruction that everybody talks about were advanced financial products. If you think of Lehman Brothers, it all comes down to this. Picture a rocket ship 3,000 feet in the air, and at the top of the rocket is a capsule with some astronauts from another era, from the 1970s. And in the rocket, there's this fuel, there's this technology of 21st century power, and that represents, you know, kind of what was going on inside of Lehman Brothers. But the people at the top really didn't know much about these new financial products, and they drove us 160 miles an hour right into the iceberg.
Louise, you were watching what was happening on the iceberg. Tell me your recollection of that day on the street.
Well, I remember that weekend when everyone thought Lehman might be saved. People didn't really think it would file for bankruptcy. The workers there, Larry, you probably remember, are calling each other constantly saying, they're going to save us, they're going to save us. But then by that night, by Sunday night, news came out that Bank of America was buying Merrill, not Lehman, and it looked like Lehman was going to file for bankruptcy. That's when workers started plowing out with their boxes. It's one of the most famous images from Lehman collapsing is, you know, these people who are traders and bankers and made a lot of money are hulking out their stuff. And I went to a couple bars that Sunday night before the bankruptcy filing, the Palm Restaurant, which is near Lehman, and an Irish bar. And that's
both normal hangouts for the Wall Street guys.
Normal hangouts, and particularly for Lehman, since they were located near Lehman. And that's where a lot of the workers were. And they were incredibly angry, angry at Dick Fold, angry at the media, who they felt might have hastened their demise, angry at short sellers who were betting against the stock, angry at the government. They were angry at everyone, and it was really kind of a sad night.
That's Louise Story from the New York Times. Also, Lawrence McDonald is the author of a book about the failure of Lehman Brothers. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
So tonight, the president goes before Congress to pitch his health care plan. What do you want to hear, and what's your take? Tell us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's one takeaway on that.
60% of the public, surprisingly, in a recent CBS poll, supports the public option, the most controversial element.
That's Cheryl Gay Stolberg, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. We talked with her and people who are on the fence. We'll talk to those people tomorrow, too. They'll be watching the speech, and we'll find out if they've made up their minds. I will be in Detroit this evening. We're participating in a town hall on health care thrown by the great WDET in Detroit. It's a chance for listeners there and members of the community to come out and get their questions answered about this complex, important piece of legislation. It's all happening at Wayne State University tonight. You can find out more information on wayne.edu.
And we'll be hearing from you tomorrow on what happens.
Yes, indeed. I'll be here with the postmortem on the president's speech and the town hall in the morning with you, Lynn. And on thetakeaway.org right now, we have a review on rap star Jay-Z's new album. David Wall Rice has a blog post. And find out whether you should be rapping along. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm Lynn Scherr, and this is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.